Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled The Second Paramita, Right Conduct, by Lama Tom Broadwater. The explanation for the second paramita, transcendent virtue, can be complicated, but most basically the virtue places emphasis on being honest and straightforward. This is how we explore right conduct in this talk. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Okay, thanks very much. I asked Lama Tom's permission to take the first minute or so of his time today for a couple of brief announcements. In 2012, Lama Tom completed his three-year retreat, and with Kempo Kartha Rinpoche's blessing, began helping as a teaching lama. This means that last year was his 10th anniversary, which we totally missed. And in the crush of business, we missed his 10th anniversary of teaching, and we want you to know how much we appreciate what you are giving to us and all of the service that you've given in the last 10 years and hopefully beyond. And that we just want you to know how much we appreciate you. I know that Father's Day is not until next month, and you're not scheduled to teach on Father's Day. So since you're not going to be here for Father's Day next month, but you are here for Mother's Day, and because the word Lama means insurpassable mother for sentient beings, I'd like to make this Mother's Day presentation to Lama Tom of a treasure vase and a kata to thank him for and congratulate him on 10 years of service to Kempo Kartha Rinpoche's vision. It was Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, the founder of this center, it was his vision that Western teachers would be able to come into retreat, finish retreat, and graduate from retreat, and graduating from retreat become insurpassable mothers to all sentient beings. And so I want to just say thank you very much, Lama Tom, and we hope you have a long life, excellent health, and continue to teach Dharma for us and for all. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lama. This the base is a. This is it has the eight auspicious numbers on it, and each one of those stands for one of the physical characteristics of the Buddha. So, by giving you this, may your life be long, your health excellent, and your Dharma activity continuous. So, thank you. Lama, for you. Yes, thank you very much. And, all the best. Well, thank you, you're the best. Okay, thank you so much, Lama. So, thank you for letting me embarrass you in public. I did warn you. So, please turn the wheel of Dharma for the benefit of peace. Thank you, everyone.
Lama Kathy, happy Mother's Day to you, because you have been the spiritual mother to many, many people. So thank you. And happy Mother's Day to everybody else, because according to Buddhist teaching, from beginningless lifetimes, we have been reborn. So one time or another, you were my mother, I was your mother at one time or another. So happy Mother's Day. I see a few new people around. Welcome, glad to see you here. Good to see folks here. So today, to begin our talk, I think it's really important that we have certain attitudes. And the first attitude is to have a big mind, to be including all people in our consideration here, thinking of all the folks that color our lives, are important to us, and bring them here in gratitude. And so we include everyone. The second attitude we should have is a loving mind, a mind that loves all beings in an unbiased way as best we can. And finally, to have a happy mind, a mind that has met the Dharma, has met good teachers, and we can be grateful for that, and we can be happy about that. So we usually begin with prayers, right? The refuge prayer. It's basically a vow, right? We say it all the time. It's a part of any introduction to a talk or any special occasion in Buddhist temples. Ask yourself, how well are you following that vow? How many, by the way, has everyone here taken the vow? Just about everyone? Some have not, but it's basically a vow that until we are enlightened, we'll follow the six paramitas, the six virtues, and that we will use those to gain enlightenment, not just for ourselves, but for all beings. And we only are going to take refuge in the Buddha, his teachings, and those that have perfected those teachings. And my thought is that every day we take refuge in all kinds of other things besides the Buddha and the Dharma. Every day. We think something out there external is going to make us happy. And we are inevitably, at some point or another, going to be disappointed. So we take refuge. Some of the great masters tell us to take refuge frequently. I have a student that I have been working with who went to Kimpo Urgen and said, what practice should I do? And Kimpo Urgen told him, say refuge six times a day. When he gets up in the morning, in the middle of the morning, at noon, early in the afternoon, late afternoon, and before he goes to bed at night, to remind himself of the importance of that vow. But we really don't fully understand it. I don't fully understand it yet. And I probably won't until I actually reach true levels of bodhisattva. So let's recite the prayer. It's on this little sheet. So in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you. So the last couple of months I've been talking about the way of the Bodhisattva. In fact, the last 4 or 5 months I've been talking about the way of the Bodhisattva. a bodhisattva is basically someone dedicated to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. And there are certain virtues that a bodhisattva observes, follows, is committed to. And those are called paramitas, which basically means that which gets us to the far shore. So those are virtues. The last time we talked, I talked about generosity. That's the first virtue. Today we're going to talk about morality, ethics, or what many people call right conduct. So we're going to talk about that. Beyond that, the other virtues, the other four virtues are patience, diligence, concentration, and wisdom. Those are referred to in different ways with different names depending upon the teacher. Leading up to my talk on generosity, I talked about bodhicitta. Bodhi means enlightenment. Citta means heart or mind. So it's the heart and mind of enlightenment. We further divided that word into two categories, relative and ultimate. Ultimate bodhicitta, the ultimate heart of enlightenment, is knowing things as they really are. The illusory nature of things, the appearance emptiness of all things. That could be a talk on itself, right? We won't go into that much, other than to say that we are striving for that heart of enlightenment that knows things as they really are. There is also what's called relative bodhicitta, which is the unselfish love and compassion for all beings, and a desire, because of that love and that compassion, to liberate all beings. Now then, we're going to another category. So relative is divided up into two more categories. Aspiration, where we aspire to benefit beings, and finally practice bodhicitta. And this is where the six paramitas come in. This is where we practice this heart of enlightenment. Buddhist Mahayana paramitas or virtues are different than just ordinary virtue. There's two things about these virtues. First of all, it is non-dual, which means there's no, how do I put this? There's no me giving, there's no giver, there's no nothing given. It's all illusion. And so we don't, so it's unselfish. There's nothing selfish about this, these virtues. And the other thing is that when we conduct ourselves in this way, in these virtues, we do it with love, compassion, and wisdom. And that wisdom, again, is the knowing the reality of the illusion-like nature of reality. The other thing I'll tell you is that you can't do one virtue without the others being present. I mean, to really do them. You cannot be generous according to the Mahayana without wisdom also being present, without patience also being present. We divide them up in different aspects, but in fact, when we are doing one properly, we are doing them all. I'll review just for a minute, what does generosity mean? It doesn't mean giving stuff. You know, it's not about giving your money away, or it's about giving up. Giving up self. Being open to other people. Whatever you're giving or whatever you're doing. You know, one of the examples of generosity is giving Dharma talks. Well, I've seen lots of people give Dharma talks that didn't have very much generosity in their hearts, love or wisdom, for that matter. I know. But generosity is about giving up, and it's about giving up ego. Ego's a shrewd survivor. It's one of the trickiest things in the universe, according to Kimpo Ken Holmes. Even though it's an illusion, we don't like to give it up. Milarepa, one of the great saints in Buddhist lore, says generosity is giving without attachment, going beyond me. So in refuge, we promise to become a Buddha, right? I mean, that's what it says, until I reach enlightenment. So we want to become a Buddha, to find our true nature and then liberate all beings. So when we take this refuge vow, we're no longer seekers, we're finders. We found the Buddha, who's the greatest teacher. We found the Dharma, which are the greatest teachings. And we have found teachers who have completely followed and incorporated into their lives the Dharma. We reinforce that original refuge vow with an additional what they call bodhisattva vow. Have some of you taken that vow? Has anyone taken that? It's a couple of them. Okay. It's where you promise to give yourself to everybody. You make a gift of yourself. You promise. You make a promise that for the now until you are awake, you will strive to give yourself as a gift to other people. And so we're closing the door on ego, pride, and anger, and all those sorts of things. And for us, this bodhisattva vow is basically going to be involved in our engagement with other people. In fact, other people are our training ground. We're going to use life situations as a mirror to understand what this long-term survivor ego is all about. So the next paramita is right conduct, in which we make the commitment to make this engagement that we have with other people better and better. Spoiler alert here. This engagement with other people will provoke anger, jealousy, and so we need the next virtue, which is patience. My experience is frequently other people are problematic. In terms of the paramitas themselves, they go from the grosser, you might say, to the more subtle, from the easiest in some ways to the hardest. And so we begin with generosity, and the next more difficult one is right conduct. In Sanskrit, it's called Shila, which means coolness. The effect of right conduct is like shade of a tree. It's like getting out from under the hot sun of afflictive emotions. And we're going to be protected by the shade of doing the right thing. Within the Buddhist context, right conduct is about our promises and our commitments. Monks and nuns make many, many commitments. And sometimes we think those poor monks, no money, no eating after noon, no girlfriends, no boyfriends, that sort of thing. We think, oh, poor monks and nuns. On the other hand, they don't have domestic disputes. They don't have to worry about money. They don't have to worry about mowing the grass, which this time of year you have to do it once a week or more. They don't have to tend gardens. So you might say the commitments that monks make and nuns make is like a golden cage they put themselves in. But monks and nuns, with their right conduct and in terms of what their commitments they make, are demonstrating to all of us that happiness doesn't depend on anything external. Some of the happiest people I know are monks and nuns. They tell us and they show us that happiness is dependent on nothing else than their mind. So again, we speak of the golden cage of the monastery. Right conduct recognizes that happiness comes from within the mind. When we no longer depend on what is other, and we take refuge in the truth of our own mind, and we are under the shade of right conduct. Now, right conduct can be really complicated in terms of, you know, philosophy, ethics, and all that sort of thing. I'm going to try to keep it really simple here today. Just knowing that it can be a very complicated conversation. The main point, again, I go back to, the main point about right conduct is making commitments. In Buddhist practice, how we grow is by the commitments we make. If you know that, you pretty well understand right conduct. In Buddhist practice, there is no external deity that has legislated for us certain rules that we have to follow, and if we don't follow them, he or she is going to throw us into hell. There's no such divine being. The commitment we make as Buddhists is voluntary. We don't have to take refuge. We don't have to take the bodhisattva vow. We don't have to commit to the samayas of the Vajrayana, which we won't talk about too much today. But again, it's voluntary. And if we don't follow our commitments, if we don't follow our refuge vow, what's going to happen? The only thing that's going to happen is that to which we have committed to, we won't accomplish. It's that. So if we don't commit to the refuge vow, the consequence is we won't awake up. Commitments, as you know, are really powerful things. When properly done, it generates positive karma. For all the time that we uphold that vow or that commitment, we are creating good karma. We're coloring our world, and we'll explain that in a minute here. We in our bodhisattva commitment, we're identifying ourselves as bodhisattvas, right? We're making the commitment to join the family of bodhisattvas, those striving towards enlightenment for the benefit of other beings. And so we identify ourselves. And that's very powerful to identify with a family. I come from West Virginia, and down in West Virginia, down in the southern part of the state, there are the Hatfields and McCoys. You probably heard of them. If you identified as a Hatfield, for the rest of your life, you're going to have a vendetta against the McCoys and vice versa. So the identity of family can be really powerful. It colors your life for the rest of your life, every day of your life. Let's take another example of how identifying with family can really color your life. Many immigrants to this country, fleeing from poverty and tyranny, are coming to this country, and they're living in abject poverty, getting menial jobs, but because they so identify with their families, they're sending whatever they have back to their families, their aunts, their uncles, their mothers, their children, their wives. They're sending everything they have because of that strong identity they have with family. So again, this identification, who we identify with, colors the way we live. So it is when we identify as bodhisattvas in the family of bodhisattvas. It's powerful, and it can be a very positive thing. We could also say that right conduct is about the sacred promises we make. We won't talk much about it, but in the Vajrayana, we make promises to our gurus, and there are many, many promises we can make depending upon the empowerments we take. But basically, in the Vajrayana, to make it simple, it is we commit that all the time, every day, all day, we will see the world as sacred, as pure, as emptiness, appearance. The body, mind, and speech of the deity. That's a tough one. That's one that even when we make the commitment, we know we're going to break until we are fully understanding of the nature of reality. Another way of looking at these promises, these commitments of bodhisattva and of refuge, we can look at them as sort of like roots to a tree. We can draw nourishment from them. Again, as a bodhisattva, we identify with those that are dedicating their lives to the benefit of others, and as a result, gain enlightenment. As I said before, as a bodhisattva, my life is a gift to other people. In right conduct, we're striving to be totally authentic, totally clear, straightforward, and straightforward in trying to sweep away ego. in right conduct, there are no hidden agendas. When I give, it's not with something I'm holding back in my mind. I'm giving because I'm just giving. There are no masks. There's no me all the time. This is a huge task, right? This is not something easy. But I don't want to be defeatist about it, because I see people making progress on the path. But it's hard. So we use our commitment to make our mind strong, to make our mind our refuge. And on this path, we have to face the darker parts of ourselves as we shed this ego. And y'all should know we do have these darker parts. We do have these darker parts. We don't like to admit that. We tend to see these virtues as something external, outside, that we sort of can study and understand and that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is, Dharma is not outside of us. It's in us. So these virtues are about us. And again, refuge is a huge part of our journey to get rid of ego, which is obscuring our Buddha nature. Our refuge vow is the first step, and it's the source of three subsequent vows that we can take. I'm going to use some fancy terms here, and I'll try to explain them as we go along. The vows we can subsequently take after refuge vow are pratimoksha vows. I'm stumbling over the word. Prati means self. Moksha means awakening. So it is self-awakening, vows of self-awakening. With bodhisattva vows, we've already talked about, and the vajrayana vows or commitments, which we won't talk about too much today. There's all kinds of details related to each one of these types of vows, but we won't go into them too much. As I said before, there are many, many monastic vows. For men, I think it's like 200, and for women, it's 300. Don't ask me why there's more for women than men. It may have something to do with our patriarchal system. I don't know. But there are also lay vows we can commit to. And basically, the reason we take these vows is to prevent harm to ourselves and to other people. That's the first step, right? Do no harm. That's what the Buddha said. So these vows are to keep from harming ourselves and others, to release ourselves from the poisons that hurt us and others. But again, it's not like the Buddha legislated these. For example, if you look in the Vinaya, each one of the vows has a story behind them. You know, a monk or a nun had a problem. Do I do this or I do that? And they would talk about it, and they'd go to the Buddha, and then they would resolve it by making up some particular vow. And it was related to basically not refraining from hurting other people. I'm going to digress for just a minute and tell you a little story, something I learned recently. The Buddha said, according to Thai Sithu, that his teachings will exist for 5,000 years, and then there will be no more teachings. A new Buddha may come along then. We are in the middle of that period, and it's a period of degeneration. Does it feel like that sometimes out there in the real world? Yeah. But it is a period of degeneration. And for us, simply to avoid falling into harming others is on the same scale as those original disciples who were enlivened by the presence of the Buddha. They could do really wild things because they were so close to the Buddha. Miraculous things. In this age of degeneration, if right conduct means nothing more than we avoid harming others, we are doing the same as those original disciples because of the age we live in. So right conduct is really important. So we want to try not to harm others, and we want to try to do good, right? And there's a third thing we try to do in right conduct, which is we try to learn skillful ways to benefit other beings. And that's a hard thing to do. You know, we try to help people thinking they're just like us. Right? And that always winds up, not always, that frequently winds up in disaster. So we have to learn how to be helpful to other beings, and we have to be able to do that skillfully, and that's a part of right conduct. According to the teachings, there are certain things that are required, certain aspects are required in order for us to make a commitment, to make a vow. First thing, obviously, is we have to do it properly. We have to plug in to the lineage. We have to plug into an authentic lineage. So we need to receive the vow properly. The second thing is we have to have a good motivation. Something that we sometimes get into is we wear our commitments like badges, and we go around acting real proud. That's not a commitment. That's an ego display. Our commitments are not flashy badges we wear to prove to other people how good we are. So motivation is important. The third thing that we have to have if we're going to make a commitment is, you know, we're going to backslide once in a while, right? We're not always going to be perfect in our execution of the vows. So we have to know remedies, how to get back, how to restore those vows. And the great teachers tell us one of the ways to do that is say the refuge vow 6 times a day to remind ourselves of that vow. So when things go wrong, we need remedies, a way to get back to them, confession and so forth. Finally, if we take these vows, it's not a one-time kind of a deal. We have to respect them, and we have to nurture them. Respect the vow you take. Honor it. So for lay folks and for monastics too, there are five basic vows, pratica mocha vows, or five precepts. They are: don't kill, don't steal, don't have inappropriate sex, and from the standpoint of a monk or nun, it's to have no sex, not to lie, and to take no intoxicants. We can take all of those, or we can take none of them. But we need to take at least one of them in order to take the bodhisattva vow. And the one people most often take is not to kill. Ideally, when we're taking the bodhisattva vow, we take all five. If you're a monk or nun, just as a point of interest, you have to take at least four of the five. And for them, usually it is not to kill, steal, no sex, not to lie, and those four. There are for some of these precepts that once you have broken them, you can't take them again. For example, if a nun or a monk were to have sex, they could no longer be a monk or nun. Milarepa one time said that if we take one of these vows, refuge vow, precept vows, bodhisattva vows, guard them like you guard your eyes. So when someone comes up to hit you, first thing you likely to do is to guard your eyes, right? Where he's saying, just like that, guard the vows you make. So to review and summarize, generosity is nothing else than dispelling this me, me, me. And as Milarepa said, right conduct is nothing other than ending deception and hypocrisy, being authentic without a hidden agenda. When I was doing this talk, I started thinking to myself how I have failed so frequently, particularly in the last, for whatever reason, last few months. How often I have taken refuge in things other than the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. How often I have broken my bodhisattva vow to put others before myself. But I'm not going to be a defeatist about it. It's a fact, that's what's happened, but I'm not going to be a defeatist. Trungpa Rinpoche, who is one of the greatest teachers within our lineage, who right now is very ill in Tibet, or not Tibet, in Nepal, in the hospital, a wonderful teacher. I had the occasion of meeting him three or four times. He's got this mouth of teeth that when he smiles, the whole room sort of lights up. He's a wonderful teacher. I found a quote that was encouraging to me. So the point here is we're going to fail in our execution frequently, in trying to dispel our ego, in our effort to put others before ourselves. We're going to fail. But Trungpa Rinpoche has this to say, and it's in Luminous Clarity, the book, Luminous Clarity. He said, we should be quite gentle when judging ourselves. And remember, the habits we are fighting against come from beginningless time and are very strong. So from time to time, we're going to backslide. But in the long run, we can make progress and improvement. And that's what I have to say about myself. I noticed my backsliding in the last couple of months. But I'm not a defeatist, and I also look at the fact that where would I have been had I not taken that vow? I've made some progress. I've done some improving. He said, and I quote, furthermore, remember that even having entered the gate of Dharma, having the intention to reduce our afflictive emotions, our disturbing emotions, is amazing. Because most people in this world never, ever even think about this. So it is amazing that even in this period, this degenerate period, we have thoughts of not harming, of actually helping others. So the bottom line is, it's hard. It's hard to keep these commitments. And we'll backslide. Be gentle on yourself. And I guess the point would be is just get back in the saddle, to use another analogy. We have a few minutes for questions, comments, thoughts. It doesn't have to be about the talk, it'll be about anything. By the way, one of the most important ways to learn about Dharma is to ask questions. So anybody with a question or comment?
Hello, can you hear me? Hi. So I have a young son, and he recently joined the Boy Scouts, and part of that is there's a faith sort of reverence aspect to that. So traditionally in Boy Scouts, they talk about God quite a bit. So I had to be creative doing this Boy Scout activity and try to create something that would be more in line with Buddhist values. So it was interesting because I was doing this with him yesterday. He had made a shrine, and he did that of his own volition. I had nothing to do with it, but we did a little bit of that. But anyway, I bring it up because I tried to make a kid-friendly version of the five precepts to sort of explain these guidelines.
Wonderful.
To him. And I was wondering if I could run them by you and
yeah.
See if I did.
Oh, that's cool.
I maybe took a liberty in doing that, but so the do not kill was pretty straightforward. A do not steal, a seven-year-old can understand. In place of sexual misconduct, I said respect other people's bodies, and that mm-hmm. means you can't touch them without their permission, and they can't touch you without vice versa, yeah. Do not lie, I think he understood. And for intoxication, I just said eat and drink healthy things.
Cool.
That seem appropriate?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, you know, one of the things we shouldn't feel badly about is that when we are explaining things to children or others who might not have the subtle understanding we have, that when we're using grosser terms or terms that might not fully express what's entirely there, that's okay, because it's a matter of over time we go from the grosser understanding of what these vows are to the more subtle. And we're doing that ourselves. We will not know what the refuge vow actually means until we are in close to enlightenment. And the reason for that is we're going to be busy working on this ego and all these afflictive emotions. This is going to take up a lot of our time. We're not going to know what it means to actually take refuge until we've worked on that a bit. So we're all going from the grosser to the more subtle.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Lama Tom. Thank you very, very much. You mentioned compassion is the relationship we have with other people. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about using compassion to define right behavior. The center is writing up some right behaviors and how to deal with wrong behaviors. And I'm thinking that if I do what gives the greatest compassion to the most people, that would be a good thing. And that might guide me in the right behaviors. A little addition to that is giving, acting towards them, not as I want them to act towards me, but rather giving towards them as they want. Would that be a good guide to good behaviors to avoid harm?
Yeah, I think it's always good to ask, because people are not like ourselves. I mean, there's very few people like me or like you. So we do, it's always good to ask, how do you want to be treated? How would you like to be treated? That's a very loving thing to do, a very kind thing to do. And we can go very wrong treating people as if they were like us. We can cause a great deal of damage. So yes, I think that's good.
And to guide my actions comprehensively, although grossly, it would be focusing on what would give the most compassion to the most people.
I'd modify that a bit and say that we have to look at each person as much as we can. Sure. I don't disagree with what you're saying, but at the same time, we do have to have regard for the individual. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody? We finished? We have a minute or two here, so before we go out in this busy world, this world of degeneration, let's just take a minute to sort of rest our minds within our mind. Just rest. Not meditate, just rest your mind. Allow yourself to experience the peace of a mind resting within itself. So let's dedicate the merit of this morning, of your coming here, your listening, your contemplating the Dharma. Let's dedicate this to all suffering beings. Let's also dedicate it to the long life of Chöngu Rinpoche, who's, as I said before, quite ill in a Nepali hospital, and to all beings who suffer some sort of physical problem. So, the dedication of merit. By this merit, may all obtain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thank you all, and have a great week.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.